Our next speaker is Dr. Aaron Ritter. He also is doing double duty today, and his talk is about anxiety and depression in neurodegenerative disorders. So please welcome Dr. Aaron Ritter.
Well, thank you so much for having me speak on a very important topic, and that is anxiety and depression in neurodegenerative disorders. I think we all know the importance of the cognitive impact of neurodegenerative diseases. These are really complex diseases. As I mentioned before, earlier in my introduction to Alzheimer's disease, we have multiple pathophysiologic processes that are going on, and multiple brain systems are affected. And so we get a wide range of both cognitive and psychiatric symptoms. And historically, the research has been focused on the cognitive features. These are the hallmarks of diseases like Alzheimer's disease. But what we're seeing from several decades of research now is that the psychiatric features are often under-recognized, and they may be even more important to patients and their families, and they have important implications for both the treatment, management, and diagnosis of these diseases. So what are neuropsychiatric symptoms of dementia? These are the psychiatric or behavioral symptoms that emerge in the context of neurologic disease, and they're very common. We know up to 80 to 90% of patients with Alzheimer's disease will experience some neuropsychiatric symptoms during the course of the disease. Behavioral symptoms are required for a diagnosis of frontotemporal dementia. So that's the hallmark of frontotemporal dementia, is changes in behavior or psychiatric symptoms. And they're important supportive clinical features of Parkinson's disease dementia and dementia with Lewy bodies. So these are prevalent symptoms that are very common in these diseases and very important. And what we're finding from the underlying biology is that the same things that are causing similar symptoms in people with idiopathic or psychiatric diseases may not be the same in neurodegenerative diseases. But they're often treated the same way, and we call this the therapeutic metaphor. So oftentimes, for example, the treatments that are used for major depression are often used in people with depressive symptoms related to Alzheimer's disease, but they may not be the same thing. So we have to think about that very carefully as we design interventions, as we measure response to treatment and our expectations for treatment. I think these symptoms are really important. Anybody that's ever seen patients with dementia knows the impact of these symptoms. Research tells us they're the primary determinant of where a patient resides, whether they're living at home or a care facility. Things like agitation and hallucinations and aggression are often the most important determinant of if a patient can remain at home. It's an important determinant of the cost of their care. As mentioned before, it's important for the differential diagnosis. So oftentimes we've looked at the presence of psychiatric symptoms, and they may be even more helpful than neurocognitive test performance. So these are important clues into the differential diagnosis. And one of the most important parts of treating psychiatric symptoms that emerge in the face of dementing illnesses is they're one of the things that may be amenable to both pharmacological and non-pharmacological treatments. And so it's one of the few areas that a clinician at this time can have a significant impact on the care for patients with dementia and their family. So this is something that if addressed properly and can have a significant impact on patients. I think it's also important to understand that some of these symptoms have a significant impact that exceeds that of the cognitive features on some patients. Many of us have seen Alzheimer's patients who are really not bothered by their cognitive impairment. Many of the patients that come here have no idea why they're coming here. They they don't remember that they don't remember, or they're unbothered by their symptoms. Making a diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease to a patient with dementia already is usually just encountered by a shrug of the shoulders. So oftentimes with the degree of anosognosia that comes with Alzheimer's disease, the cognitive features are not that bothersome. But on the other hand, I think we realize that patients with delusions are tormented by the belief that they may be victims of theft, or that there is a phantom hoarder or a boarder in the house, or that their family members are stealing their money. They're tormented by these thoughts. They may not be bothered by the fact that they don't remember, but they're tormented by delusions. Agitated patients are irritated and uncomfortable. They may pace and they may strike out. Compulsive patients are stressed and anxious. So there's a lot of suffering that goes along with these behavioral and psychiatric symptoms that accompany dementia. And as a provider, if we're only treating their cognitive symptoms, we're missing half of our obligation to treat these patients. We know patients with neuropsychiatric symptoms of dementia are more likely to be engaged in physical altercations with caregivers or with others. They're more likely to be victims of elder abuse, and they're more likely to be on pharmacological therapy. I know we focus a lot on pharmacological therapy, but non-pharmacological interventions can be very effective for these neuropsychiatric symptoms. And sometimes patients need to be medicated and need to be medicated heavily for their safety. And psychotropic medications in dementia populations increase risk for mortality, the risk of falls, cardiac abnormalities, and cerebrovascular events. So it's a significant burden and cost to the care of patients. Just to mention really quickly, antipsychotic medications have a black box warning that describes an increased risk of mortality in patients with dementia. So these medications need to be used very carefully. So some of the features of neuropsychiatric symptoms of dementia, they can emerge at any stage of the disease. They often change over time, so they're not necessarily static like some of the cognitive symptoms. Symptoms that tend to worsen during the course of dementia are agitation and apathy. We see in the graph over there when we compare people, the rates in mild cognitive impairment to people with dementia, the agitation is one symptom that tends to worsen over time. Apathy, which is the sort of lack of motivation and initiative in enjoying life and doing activities, that tends to worsen during the course of dementia. That's the most common neuropsychiatric symptom of dementia. And then some of the neuropsychiatric symptoms may come and go. So delusions and hallucinations are notorious for coming and going, so they may not be present during each stage of the disease. They're more likely to emerge in later stages of disease, but they don't always get worse over time. And they may not need to be treated pharmacologically consistently. So oftentimes they will come and go, and treatment can follow that pattern. And depression, we're going to speak a little bit more about depression, but over time, depression tends to wax and wane in patients with dementia. So when we group patients with dementia into their behavioral symptoms, we tend to see these sort of clustering of symptoms together. There's been several studies that have been summarized here in this slide about this grouping. And so we tend to see kind of a fallout of a pattern of neuropsychiatric symptoms in individuals with dementia. So about a fourth of patients have what we call an affective neuropsychiatric syndrome associated with dementia. Those are the patients that are either apathetic or depressed or irritable. We have about 13 to 15% may have psychotic symptoms. So those are the delusions and hallucinations. About 20% may have just sort of a smattering of symptoms. And then in this study, which was a study of individuals in Catch County, Utah, 40% had no symptoms at that time. Other studies have kind of found similar patterns in different populations. So we see this sort of grouping of neuropsychiatric symptoms into sort of clusters. And sort of that speaks to a shared neurobiology or psychiatric underlie to some of these symptoms. What we'll talk about a little bit more in depth today is the sort of the affective clustering of symptoms. So that's depression and anxiety. And oftentimes in this affective clustering, we include apathy as well. I'm not going to speak specifically to apathy today. It's another topic, but it's a very common symptom. But we know when we group apathy with depression, it's very highly comorbid, but it seems to exist independent of depression in many patients. So as we can see, depression and anxiety in people with dementia is very common. This is from a nursing home in Norway. And we can see that in nursing home populations, things like irritability and delusions tend to be much more common than in community populations where depression, anxiety, and apathy are more common. So it sort of depends on the setting and the convenience samples that are obtained for these studies, where we see the higher percentage of these symptoms. So let's talk about depression in Alzheimer's disease. There's a wide variation in prevalence rates, and that depends on a lot of factors. The population study, whether we're looking at nursing home populations, whether we're looking at community populations, the instruments used, so sort of the questions that are being asked, and whether we're asking the caregiver or versus self-report. Caregivers tend to report higher levels of depression than the patients do themselves in patients with dementia. I think the accepted rate is about 30 to 50% of patients with Alzheimer's disease are thought to have some depressive features to their disease. And that's much higher than folks that are non-demented, which in elderly populations has been studied to be, I think that number is a little low, but is not certainly as high as it is in dementia. Depression in Alzheimer's disease is associated with a greater caregiver burden, lower qualities of life, and it also is associated with nursing home placement. It can be associated with psychosis, wandering, and aggression. So it's something to watch for. So how do we think about depression and Alzheimer's disease? It's similar to major depressive disorder. It shares some of the features, but typically less severe. We know patients with Alzheimer's disease and depression are less likely to attempt suicide, although new data suggests people with a recent diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease when they're in the MCI phase may have increased risk of suicide attempts right after the diagnosis. But in patients that have dementia, they're less likely to attempt suicide. They're less likely to have major episodes, those episodes where people are really, really depressed and staying in bed and very apathetic. We tend to see more of the sort of residual symptoms that are chronic. The symptoms that we often see are changes in sleep, so increased need for sleep, feelings of worthlessness and guilt. And oftentimes it's hard to differentiate apathy, which is very common in Alzheimer's disease, with depression, and usually they coexist. So it's hard to untangle those, but often they exist independently of each other. So provisional criteria for dementia and Alzheimer's disease have been suggested. This is a working group from the National Institute of Mental Health convened a diagnostic working group to identify depression and Alzheimer's disease specifically. And what they came up with is based on the DSM-4 criteria. But what they did was they reduced the number of symptoms from 5 to 3 and not required them to be present every day. They added a symptom of social withdrawal or irritability, and they replaced anhedonia, this feeling of loss of sort of positive feelings, with a decreased positive affect and loss of pleasure associated with social activity. So it's slightly different than anhedonia. This is the DSM-5 criteria, and we can see the comparison. So there's a lot of overlap between the two, but a reduction in the total number of symptoms reported. There's several ways to assess for depression in Alzheimer's disease, including several rating scales that are commonly used. The geriatric depression scale is specific to people that are older individuals. The Hamilton D is sort of a standard that can that has been used in young people and older people. The NPI, which is a scale of all neuropsychiatric symptoms, can be used. And the Cornell scale for depression and dementia has been used to track response to therapy. It's sort of a semi-structured interview that is probably the best way to assess for depression in Alzheimer's disease. So what's the pathophysiology of depression, Alzheimer's disease? Because we know not everybody with Alzheimer's disease gets depression. And it's not necessarily a product of advanced disease. I think a lot of times we assumed that these symptoms would arise just in the face of advancing disease, and that's not necessarily the case. Depression may emerge in Alzheimer's disease, as I spoke about in the continuum, at the very beginning of MCI phase, and it may be a prodromal symptom. So a lot of folks that are presenting for the very first time with depression, with no lifelong history, we have to be worried about potentially this is a prodrome to their Alzheimer's disease. In general, the studies have localized findings to the ascending monoaminergic system. So we're talking about sort of the brainstem area and the neurotransmitter system. We've seen increased neuropathology in patients with depression, Alzheimer's disease in the locus coeruleus, where we see noradrenergic neurons, the raphe nucleus, where we see serotonergic neurons, and the substantia nigra, where we see the predominance of dopamine neurons. And so we see increased pathologies in these origins of the monoaminergic system. So this tends to be an area where the pathology accumulates and may differentiate a different form of Alzheimer's disease. There's been studies of CSF levels of norepinephrine, serotonin, and corticotropin releasing hormone in the CSF as being lower in patients with depression and Alzheimer's disease. So there's clearly something biochemical going on that may be the nexus of this disease. In general, imaging findings point to the frontal lobe of the brain. So it clearly is in relation to the frontal metabolism, where we see a lot of disease, and it seems to be a disease that's driven primarily by changes in the connections of the frontal lobe, where we see depression and Alzheimer's disease. So what's the treatment recommendations? Unfortunately, the treatment of depression in Alzheimer's disease has had a lot of mixed results and predominantly negative results. I think in general, the recommendation is a period of watchful waiting for milder cases. These are people with mild depressive symptoms in Alzheimer's disease. We can kind of watch and wait. We can try some of our non-pharmacological interventions. So those include increased activity, increased socialization. It's hard during this period of COVID. I know it's been incredibly hard on patients, but oftentimes social activities and increasing exercise and things like that can be tried in milder cases. Treatment should be initiated in people with severe depression. So these are folks that are very, very depressed, scoring very high on things like the GDS or the Hamilton D. When there's suicidality, and oftentimes older folks with dementia will talk about wanting to die, but not necessarily being suicidal. So I think there's a clear distinction that should be drawn there, especially in younger patients with dementia. I think we need to screen carefully for suicidality. Or another instance where we would want to be more aggressive in our pharmacological intervention is when we see depression coexist with other things like agitation. So symptoms that are creating an unsafe environment. So the first line for treatment of depression and Alzheimer's disease is the SSRIs, primarily because they're safe. Unfortunately, or fortunately, 30 to 50% of patients with Alzheimer's disease are already being prescribed antidepressants. Often they're misdiagnosed as having depression when they really have Alzheimer's disease. So patients will already be treated with antidepressants, oftentimes by the time of their diagnosis. So that creates some issues with the treatment plan. So oftentimes we can maximize the dosages or switch to stronger agents. or try other options. In general, the evidence around SSRIs is limited at best. Several meta-analyses have been done and they failed to find a benefit or separation from placebo. There are methodologic issues with these meta-analyses and studies, but in general, small studies have shown benefit, followed up by larger studies that have not shown benefit. There are two large studies, one with sertraline and mirtazapine, and one a comparison of sertraline and mirtazapine, and both were negative. But in general, using that therapeutic metaphor of treating the individual with depressive symptoms, I think we want to use SSRIs as the first line, and we want to stick to the SSRIs that have less anticholinergic effects. So we're looking at sertraline, escitalopram, and citalopram as our first line agents, starting at low doses and then increasing over time, depending on the therapeutic response. We tend to want to avoid medicines like fluoxetine and paroxetine because of the anticholinergic effects, which may worsen cognitive functioning. So in general, as I mentioned before, the data regarding the efficacy of these treatments in Alzheimer's disease is less than we would like, and it has failed to show separation from placebo. So I think the next phase is to work on agents that may have different therapeutic effects, but right now we're stuck with using the therapeutic metaphor. The American Psychiatric Association, again, follows kind of the recommendations we talked about, and we want to use SSRIs as the first line. If that fails, I would move on to an SNRI. So we have duloxetine and venlafaxine as options. And then you can add small doses of atypical antipsychotics for failure or if concurrent agitation, looking at medicines like quetiapine, risperidone, and Abilify as potential options. And then there's been several studies that have looked at ECT for refractory depression in Alzheimer's disease with some benefit. There is a clear association between depression and Alzheimer's disease, aside from having Alzheimer's disease at the time of depression. We know that early life depressive episodes are associated with an increased risk of Alzheimer's disease later in life. A meta-analysis has found that a lifetime episode of major depression doubles your risk for developing dementia, so there is a clear neurobiological link. It doesn't seem to be as high as having an ApoE genotype, but there is a relationship between depression during life and younger life and Alzheimer's disease later in life. So this is an argument for aggressive treatment of major depressive episodes earlier in life. So vortioxetine is a new medication, relatively new medication for depression that has a unique mechanism of action on multiple serotonin receptors. And it has been shown, independent of the effect on mood, to have some benefit on executive functioning. So it hasn't been studied to a high level in patients with dementia, but it has been shown to improve some cognitive functioning. So I think this is a medication that may have some benefit in Alzheimer's disease as well. And it is often seen to show some benefits in executive functioning. So we need a little bit more data on that medication, but it's an option that we've tried in our patients, and it seemed to have a good response similar to SSRIs. So depression in Parkinson's disease is very common. It's up to 50% of individuals. Again, we're seeing more minor episodes than major. We have some noted risk factors, which include being female, a personal or family history, rigid akinetic form of Parkinson's disease. And we know we have this phenomenon where we see in the off state higher levels of anxiety or depression. And we know levodopa may attenuate mood fluctuations in the off state. So there's a clear association between neurotransmitter function in Parkinson's disease and the symptoms. Again, we're localizing to neural circuits in the prefrontal cortex and the basal ganglia, so slightly different than in Alzheimer's disease. There's a higher awareness of the problems, the functional problems associated with Parkinson's disease. So in Parkinson's disease, as opposed to Alzheimer's disease, we see higher levels of depression as the disease advances. It's important to realize. The good news about treatment of depression and Parkinson's disease is that we have fairly efficacious agents. The first step often is to replace with or to add a dopamine agent in patients that can tolerate those medicines. They have been shown to increase depressive symptoms. Tricyclic antidepressants are very effective for the treatment of Parkinson's disease, depression and Parkinson's disease, and they may help with motor symptoms as well. So oftentimes low doses of TCAs are very effective. And SSRIs, so in individuals with cognitive impairment in Parkinson's disease, we want to avoid the TCAs, but we can also use the SSRIs. Sertraline and citalopram actually have really good evidence for their use. SNRIs are typically less tolerated, but can be effective. Mirtazapine has been shown to be effective for depression and also for dyskinesias. And we don't want to forget our MAO-B inhibitors, selegiline and potentially risagiline also help with depression. There is some evidence that ECT is also effective for both the motor symptoms as well as depression and Parkinson's disease. So that's also an option for our individuals with Parkinson's disease. And I think in summary, what I'd like to summarize here and just say before I take some questions that neuropsychiatric symptoms in dementia are common and disabling. They may respond to pharmaceutical intervention. In AD, depression is common, but less likely to respond to treatment than depression and Parkinson's disease. But in either case, I think there are therapeutic options and non-therapeutic options, which I didn't get a chance to talk about, but it's important for assessment and then treatment of these disabling symptoms. So now I have a couple minutes for questions, and I'd be happy to take those.
Hello, thank you, Dr. Ritter. I see that Dr. Ritter is busy answering the questions in the chat. So for purposes of time, we're going to move on to our next presentation from Dr. Sabah.